A large-framed, rugged man who raised beef cattle as a hobby at his Northern Virginia home, this cowboy had been born and educated in New Hampshire, but his boots were custom-made. O'Day had a phone to his ear, and the room was surprisingly quiet for a crisis room during a real crisis. A curt nod and raised hand acknowledged Murray's entry. The senior agent waited for O'Day to conclude the call.
"What's going on, Pat?"
"I was just on the phone with Andrews. They have tapes of the radar and stuff. I have agents from the Washington field office heading there to interview the tower people. National Transportation Safety Board will have people there, too, to assist. Initial word? Looks like a Japan Airlines 747 kamikazed in. The Andrews people say the pilot declared an emergency as an unscheduled KLM flight and drove straight over their runways, hung a little left, and...
Well?"
O'Day shrugged. "WFO has people on the hill now to commence the investigation. I'm assuming this one goes on the books as a terrorist incident, and that gives us jurisdiction."
"Where's the ADIC?" Murray asked,
meaning the assistant director in charge of the Bureau's Washington office, quartered at Buzzard's Point on the Potomac River.
"St. Lucia with Angie, taking a vacation. Tough luck for Tony."
The inspector grunted. Tony Caruso had gotten away only 3 days earlier.
"Tough day for a lot of people. The body count's going to be huge, Dan. Lots worse in Oklahoma. I've sent out a general alert for forensics experts. Mess like this, we'll have to identify a lot of bodies from DNA.
Oh, the TV guys are asking how it's possible for the Air Force to let this happen." A shake of the head accompanied the conclusion. O'Day needed somebody to dump on, and the TV commentators were the most attractive target of opportunity. There would be others in due course. Both hoped the FBI would not be one of them.
"Anything else we know?"
Pat shook his head.
"Nope, it's going to take time, Dan."
"Ryan?"
"Was on the Hill. Should be on his way to the White House. They caught him on TV. He looks kind of rocky. Our brothers and sisters at USSS are having a really bad night, too. The guy I talked to 10 minutes ago almost lost it. We might end up having a jurisdictional conflict over who runs the investigation."
"Great," Murray snorted.
"We'll let the AG sort that one."
But there wasn't an attorney general, and there wasn't a secretary of the treasury for him to call.
Inspector O'Day didn't have to run through it. A federal statute empowered the United States Secret Service as lead agency to investigate any attack on the president. But another federal statute gave FBI jurisdiction over terrorism. A local statute for murder also brought the Washington Metropolitan Police in, of course. Toss in the National Transportation Safety Board. Until proven otherwise, it could merely be a horrible aircraft accident. And that was just the beginning. Every agency had authority and expertise. The Secret Service, smaller than the FBI, and with fewer resources, did have some superb investigators, and some of the finest technical experts around. NTSB knew more about airplane crashes than anyone in the world. But the Bureau had to be the lead agency for this investigation, didn't it? Murray thought. Except that Director Shaw was dead, and without him to swing the clout club.
Jesus, Murray thought.
He and Bill went back to the academy together. They'd worked in the same squad as rookie street agents in Riverside, Philadelphia, chasing bank robbers. Pat read his face and nodded.
Yeah, Dan, takes time to catch up, doesn't it? We've been gutted like a fish, man.
He handed over a sheet from a legal pad with a handwritten list of known dead.
A nuclear strike wouldn't have hurt us this badly, Murray realized as he scanned the names.
A developing crisis would have given ample strategic warning, and slowly, quietly, senior people would have left Washington for various places of safety. Many of them would have survived.
or so the planners went, and after the strike there would have been some sort of functioning government to pick up the pieces. But not now.
Ryan had come to the White House 1,000 times to visit, to deliver briefings, for meetings important and otherwise, and most recently to work in his own office as National Security Advisor. This was the first time he hadn't had to show ID and walk through the metal detectors. More properly, he did walk straight through one from force of habit, but this time, when the buzzer went off, he just kept walking without even reaching for his keys. The difference in demeanor of the Secret Service agents was striking. Like anyone else, they were comforted by familiar surroundings, and though the entire country had just had another lesson in how illusory safety was, the illusion was real enough for trained professionals to feel more at ease within the substance of a lie. Guns were holstered, coats buttoned, and long breaths taken as the entourage came in through the east entrance. An inner voice told Jack that this was now his house, but he had no wish to believe it. Presidents liked to call it the people's house, to use the political voice of false modesty to describe a place for which some of them would have willingly run over the bodies of their own children, then say that it wasn't really all that big a thing. If lies could stain the walls, Jack reflected, then this building would have a very different name. But there was greatness here, too, and that was more intimidating than the pettiness of politics. Here James Monroe had promulgated the Monroe Doctrine and propelled his country into the strategic world for the first time. Here Lincoln had held his country together through the sheer force of his own will. Here Teddy Roosevelt had made America a real global player, and sent his great white fleet around the world to announce American. Here Teddy's distant cousin had saved his country from internal chaos and despair, with little more than a nasal voice and an up-angled cigarette holder. Here Eisenhower had exercised power so skillfully that hardly anyone had noticed his doing anything at all. Here Kennedy had faced down Khrushchev, and nobody had cared that doing so had covered a multitude of blunders. Here Reagan had plotted the destruction of America's most dangerous enemy, only to be accused of sleeping most of the time. What ultimately counted more, the achievements or the dirty little secrets committed by imperfect men who only briefly stepped beyond their weaknesses? But those brief and halting steps made up the sort of history that lived, while the rest was, mainly, forgotten. Except by revisionist historians who just didn't get the fact that people weren't supposed to be perfect. But it still wasn't his house. The entrance was a tunnel of sorts, which headed under the east wing, where the First Lady, until 90 minutes earlier, Anne Durling, had her offices. By law, the First Lady was a private citizen. An odd fiction for someone with a paid staff, but in reality her functions were often hugely important, however unofficial they might be. The walls here were those of a museum, not a home, as they walked past the small White House theater, where the president could watch movies with 100 or so close personal friends. There were several sculptures, many by Frederick Remington, and the general motif was supposed to be pure American. The paintings were of past presidents, and Ryan's eyes caught them. Their lifeless eyes seemed to look down at him with suspicion and doubt. All the men who had gone before, good and bad, whether judged well or poorly by historians, they looked at him. "I'm an historian," Ryan told himself. "I've written a few books. I've judged the actions of others from a safe distance of both time and space. Why didn't he see this? Why didn't he do that?" Now, too late, he knew better. He was here now, and from the inside it looked very different. From the outside you could see in, looking around first to catch all the information and analyze it as it passed by, stopping it when you had to, even making it go backward, the better to understand it all, taking your time to get things exactly right.
but from the inside it wasn't that way at all. Here everything came directly at you like a series of onrushing trains, from all directions at once, moving by their own time schedules, leaving you little room to maneuver or reflect. Ryan could sense that already. And the people in the paintings had mainly come to this place with the luxury of time to think about their ascension, with the luxury of trusted advisors and of goodwill. Those were benefits he didn't have. To historians, however, they wouldn't matter for much more than a cursory paragraph, or maybe even a whole page, before the writer moved on with pitiless analysis. Everything he said or did, Jack knew, would be subjected to the 2020 vision of hindsight, and not just from this moment forward. People would now look into his past for information on his character, his beliefs, his actions good and bad. From the moment the aircraft had struck the Capitol building, he was president, and every breath he'd drawn since would be examined in a new and unforgiving light for generations to come. His daily life would have no privacy, and even in death he would not be safe from scrutiny by people who had no idea what it was like merely to walk into this oversized dwelling, office, museum, and know that it was your prison into all eternity. The bars were invisible, perhaps, but even more real because of it. So many men had lusted for this job only to find how horrid and frustrating it was. Jack knew that from his own historical readings, and from seeing three men at close quarters who'd occupied the Oval Office. At least they had come here with eyes supposedly open, and perhaps they could be blamed for having minds smaller than their egos. How much the worse for someone who'd never wished for it? And would history judge Ryan more kindly for it? That was worth an ironic snort. No, he'd come to this house at a time when his country needed, and if he didn't meet that need, then he'd be cursed for all future time as a failure, even though he'd come to the job only by accident, condemned by a man now dead to do the job which the other man had craved. For the Secret Service, this was a time to relax a little. Lucky them, Ryan thought, allowing bitterness to creep into his mind, unfair or not. It was their job to protect him and his family. It was his job now to protect them and theirs, and those of millions of others. "This way, Mr. President." Price turned left into the ground floor corridor. Here Ryan first saw the White House staff people, standing there to see their new charge, the man whom they would serve to the best of their abilities. Like everyone else, they just stood and looked, without knowing what to say, their eyes evaluating the man and without revealing what they thought, though they would surely exchange views in the privacy of their locker or lunch rooms at the first possible moment. Jack's tie was still crooked in his collar, and he still wore the turnout coat. The water spray that had frozen in his hair and given him an undeserved gray look was melting now. One of the staff members raced out of sight as the entourage continued west. He reappeared a minute later, darting through the security detail and handing Ryan a towel. "Thank you," Jack said in surprise. He stood still for a moment and started drying his hair. There he saw a photographer running backward and aiming his camera, snapping merrily away. The Secret Service didn't impede him in any way. That, Ryan thought, made him a member of the staff, the official White House photographer whose job it was to memorialize everything. "Great, my own people spy on me." But it wasn't time to interfere with anything, was it? "Where are we going, Andrea?" Jack asked, as they passed yet more portraits of presidents and first ladies all staring at him.
"The Oval Office. I thought—"
"Situation room." Ryan stopped dead, still toweling off. "I'm not ready for that room yet, okay?"
"Of course, Mr. President."
At the end of the wide corridor, they turned left into a small foyer walled with cheap-looking wood latticework, and then right to go outside again, because there wasn't a corridor from the White House into the West Wing. That's why no one had taken his coat, Jack realized. "Coffee," Jack ordered. At least the food service would be good here. The White House mess was run by Navy stewards, and his first presidential cup of coffee was poured into an exquisite cup from a silver pot, by a sailor whose smile was both professional and genuine, and who, like everyone else, was curious about the new boss. It occurred to Ryan that he was like a creature in the zoo. Interesting, even fascinating. And how would he adapt to the new cage? Same room, different seat. The president sat in the middle of the table so that aides could assemble on both sides. Ryan picked his place and sat in it naturally enough. It was only a chair, after all. The so-called trappings of power were merely things, and the power itself was an illusion, because such power was always accompanied by obligations that were greater still. You could see and exercise the former. The latter could only be felt. Those obligations came with the air, which suddenly seemed heavy in this windowless room. Jack sipped at his coffee briefly, looking around. The wall clock said 11:14 p.m. He'd been president for, what, 90 minutes? About the time for the drive from his home to his new home, depending on traffic. Where's Arnie?
Right here, Mr. President, Arnold Van Dam said as he came through the door. Chief of staff to two presidents, he would now set an all-time record as chief of staff to a third. His first president had resigned in disgrace. His second was dead. Would the third one be the charm? Or did bad things always come in threes? Two adages equally quoted and mutually exclusive. Ryan's eyes just bored in on him, asking the question that he couldn't voice. What do I do now?
Good statement on TV, just about right. The chief of staff sat down on the other side of the table. He appeared quiet and competent, as always, and Ryan didn't reflect on the effort such an appearance required of a man who'd lost more friends than Ryan had.
"I'm not even sure what the hell I said," Jack replied, searching his mind for memories that had vanished.
"That's about normal for an ad lib," Van Dam allowed. "It was still pretty good. I always thought your instincts were okay. You're going to need 'em."
"First thing?" Jack asked.
"Banks, stock markets, all federal offices are closed. Call it till the end of the week. Maybe beyond that. We have a state funeral to plan for Roger and Ann.
National week of mourning, probably a month for the flags to be at half-staff. We had a bunch of ambassadors in the chamber, too. That means a ton of diplomatic activity on top of everything else. We'll call that housekeeping stuff."
"I know," Van Dam said with a raised hand.
"Sorry. You have to call it something."
"Who?"
"We have a protocol office here, Jack," Van Dam pointed out. "They're already in their cubbyholes and working on this for you. We have a team of speechwriters. They'll prepare your official statements. The media people will want to see you. What I mean by that is, you have to appear in public. You have to reassure people. You have to instill confidence."
"When?"
"In time for the morning TV shows at the latest. CNN, all the networks. I'd prefer that we go on camera within the hour, but we don't have to. We can cover that by saying you're busy."
"You will be," Arnie promised.
"You'll have to be briefed on what you can say and what you can't before you go on TV. We'll lay the law down to the newsies on what they may and may not ask, and in a case like this they'll cooperate. Figure you have a week of kind treatment to lean on. That's your press honeymoon, and that's as long as it'll last."
"And then?" Jack asked.
"And then you're the by God president, and you'll have to act like it, Jack," Van Dam said bluntly. "You didn't have to take the oath, remember?" That statement made Ryan's head jerk back as his peripheral vision caught the stony looks on the others in the room, all of them Secret Service at the moment. He was the new boss, and their eyes weren't so very different now from those in the portraits on the walk in from the East Wing. They expected him to do the right thing. They'd support him, protect him from others and from himself. But he had to do the job. They wouldn't let him run away, either. The Secret Service was empowered to protect him from physical danger.
Arnie Van Dam would try to protect him from political danger. Other staffers would serve and protect, too. The housekeeping staff would feed him, iron his shirts, and fetch coffee. But none of them would allow Ryan to run away, either from his place or his duties. It was a prison.
But what Arnie had just said was true. He could have refused to take the oath, couldn't... No, Ryan thought, looking down at the polished oak tabletop. Then he would have been damned for all eternity as a coward. Worse, he would have been damned in his own mind as the same thing, for he had a conscience that was more harmful an enemy than any outsider. It was his nature to look in the mirror and see not enough there. As good a man as he knew himself to be, he was never good enough. Driven by what? The values he'd learned from his parents, his educators, the Marine Corps, the many people he'd met, the dangers he'd faced? All those abstract values, did he use them, or did they use him? What had brought him to this point? What had made him what he was? And what really was John Patrick Ryan? He looked up, around the room, wondering what they thought he was. But they didn't know either. He was the president now, the giver of orders, which they would carry out. The man who made speeches which others would analyze for nuance and correctness. The man who decided what the United States of America would do, then to be judged and criticized by others who never really knew how to do the thing to which they objected. But that wasn't a person. That was a job description. Inside of that had to be a man, or someday soon a woman, who thought it through and tried to do the right thing. And for Ryan, less than an hour and a half before, the right thing had been to take the oath, and to try to do his best. The judgment of history was ultimately less important than what he'd judge of himself, looking in the mirror every morning at not enough. The real prison was, and would always be, himself. Damn. The fire was out now, Chief McGill saw. His people would have to be careful. There were always hot spots, places where the fire had died, not from the cooling water, but rather from lack of oxygen, and waited for the chance to flare back up, to surprise and kill the unwary. But his people were wary, and those little flares of malevolent life would not be important in the greater scheme of things for this firesite. Hoses were already being rolled, and some of his people were taking their trucks back to their houses. He'd stripped the entire city of apparatus for this fire, and he had to send much of it back, lest a new fire go unanswered, and more people die unnecessarily. He was surrounded by others now, all wearing one-layer vinyl jackets with large yellow letters to proclaim who they were. There was an FBI contingent, another from Secret Service, the D.C. Metropolitan Police, NTSB, the Treasury Department's Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and his own fire investigators, all looking for someone to be in charge so that they could claim command themselves. Instead of holding an informal meeting and establishing their own chain of command, they stood mostly in homogeneous little knots, probably waiting for someone else to tell them who was running things. McGill shook his head. He'd seen it before. The bodies were coming out faster now. For the moment, they were being taken to the D.C. Armory, about a mile north of the hill just off the railroad tracks. McGill didn't envy the identification teams, though he hadn't yet troubled himself to descend into the crater. That's how he thought of it at the moment, to see how badly destroyed things were. "Chief?" a voice asked behind him. McGill turned. "Yeah?" "NTSB, can we start looking for the flight recorder?" The man pointed to the rudder fin. Though the tail assembly of the aircraft was anything but intact, you could tell what it had once been, and the so-called black box, actually painted day-glow orange, would be somewhere in there. The area was actually fairly clean. The rubble had been catapulted westward for the most part, and they might actually have a chance of recovering it quickly. "Okay.
McGill nodded and pointed to a pair of firefighters to accompany the crash team.
Could you also tell your people as much as possible not to move the aircraft parts around? We need to reconstruct the event, and it helps to leave things pretty much in place.
The people, the bodies, come first, McGill pointed out. The federal official nodded with a grimace. This wasn't fun for anyone.
I understand. He paused. If you find the flight crew, please don't move them at all. Call us and we'll handle it, okay?
How will we know? White shirts, shoulder boards with stripes on them, and they'll be Japanese, probably.
It should have sounded crazy, but it didn't. McGill knew that bodies often did survive airplane crashes in the most incredible outward condition, so intact that only a trained eye could see the signs of fatal injury on first inspection. It often unnerved the civilians who were usually the first to arrive at a scene. It was so strange that the human body seemed more robust than the life it contained. There was a mercy to it, for the survivors were spared the hellish ordeal of identifying a piece of burned, torn meat. But that mercy was balanced by the cruelty of recognizing someone that could not talk back. McGill shook his head and had one of his senior people relay the special order. The firefighters down below had enough of them already. The first special order, of course, had been to locate and remove the body of President Roger Durling. Everything was secondary to that, and a special ambulance was standing by for his body alone. Even the First Lady, Anne Durling, would have to wait a little for her husband one last time. A contractor's mobile crane was maneuvering into the far side of the building to lift out the stone cubes that covered the podium area like a battered pile of children's hardwood blocks. In the harsh light, it seemed that only the letters and numbers painted on their sides were lacking to make the illusion complete. People were streaming into all the government departments, especially the senior officials. It was hardly the usual thing for the VIP parking slots to fill up at midnight, but this night they did, and the Department of State was no exception. Security personnel were called in as well, for an attack on one government agency was an attack on all, and even though the nature of the attack on the government devalued the advantage of calling in people armed with handguns, it didn't really matter. When A happened, B resulted, because it was written down somewhere that B was what you did. The people with the handguns looked at one another and shook their heads, knowing that they'd be getting overtime pay, which put them one up on the big shots who'd storm in from their places in Chevy Chase and suburban Virginia, race upstairs, and then just chat with one another. One such person found his parking place in the basement and used his key card to activate the VIP elevator to the 7th floor. What made him different was that he had a real mission for the evening, albeit one he'd wondered about all the way in from his Great Falls home. It was what he thought of as a gut check, though that term hardly applied here. Yet what else could he do? He owed Ed Keelty everything, his place in Washington society, his career at State, so many other things. The country needed someone like Ed right now. So Ed had told him, making a strong case for the proposition, and what he himself was doing was... what? A small voice in the car had called it treason, but no, that wasn't so, because treason was the only crime defined in the Constitution, cited there as giving aid and comfort to the enemies of his country. And whatever Ed Keelty was doing, he wasn't doing that, was he? It came down to loyalty. He was Ed Keelty's man, as were many others. The relationship had started at Harvard, with beers and double dates and weekends at his family's house on the water, the good times of a lively youth. He'd been the working-class guest of one of America's great families. Why? Because he'd caught Ed's youthful eye. But why that? He didn't know, had never asked, and probably would never find out. That was the way of friendship. It just happened. And only in America could a working-class kid who'd scratched into Harvard on a scholarship get befriended by the great son of a great family. He would have done well on his own, probably. No one but God had given him his native intelligence. No one but his parents had encouraged his development of that gift and taught him manners and values. The thought caused his eyes to close as the elevator doors opened. Values. Well, loyalty was one of those values, wasn't it? Without Ed's patronage, he would have topped out, maybe, as a DAS, as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. The first word had long since been expunged from the title painted in gold letters on his office door. In a just world, he would have been in the running for the removal of the next word from the title as well. For wasn't he as good with foreign policy as anyone else on the seventh floor? Yes, he surely was. And that would not have come to be without his having been Ed Keelty's man. Without the parties where he'd met the other mover-shakers and talked his way to the top. And the money. He'd never taken a bribe of any sort, but his friend had advised him wisely, the advice having come from his own advisers, but that didn't matter, on investments, allowing him to build up his own financial independence. And, by the way, buy a 5,000-square-foot home in Great Falls. And to put his own son into Harvard, not on a scholarship. For Clifton Rutledge III was the son of somebody now, not merely the issue of a worker's loins. All the work he might have done entirely on his own would not have brought him to this place, and loyalty was owed, wasn't it? That made it a little easier for Clifton Rutledge II. Actually, his birth certificate said Clifton Rutledge Jr., but Jr. wasn't quite the suffix for a man of his station. Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs. The rest was merely timing. The seventh floor was always guarded, all the more so now. But the guards all knew him, and it was merely a matter of looking like he knew what he was doing. Hell, Rutledge told himself, he might just fail. And that could well be the best possible outcome. Sorry, Ed, it wasn't there. He wondered if that was an unworthy thought as he stood there by his office door, listening for footsteps that would match in speed the beating of his heart. There would be two guards on the floor now, walking about separately. Security didn't have to be all that tight at a place like this. Nobody got into state without a reason. Even in daytime, when visitors came in, they needed escorts to wherever they were going. At this time of night, things were tighter still. The number of elevators in service was reduced. Key card access was needed to get all the way to the top floor, and a third guard was always at the elevator banks. So it was just timing. Rutledge checked his watch for several cycles of footsteps, and found that the intervals were regular to within 10 seconds. Good. He just had to wait for the next one. Hi, Wally.
Good evening, sir. The guard replied. Bad night.
Do us a favor.
What's that, sir?
Coffee. No secretaries to get the machines going. Could you skip down to the cafeteria and have one of their people bring an urn up here? Have them set it up in the conference room up the hall. We'll be having a meeting in a few minutes.
Fair enough. Right away?
If you could, Wally.
Be back in 5, Mr. Rutledge.
The guard strode off with purpose, turned right 20 yards away, and disappeared from view. Rutledge counted to 10 and headed the other way. The double doors to the Secretary of State's office were not locked. Rutledge walked right in through the first set, then through the second, turning on the lights as he did so. He had 3 minutes. Half of him hoped that the document would be locked away in Brett Hansen's office vault. In that case, he would surely fail, since only Brett, two of his assistants, and the chief of security had the combination. And that did have an anti-tamper alarm on it. But Brett had been a gentleman, and a careless one at that, always so trusting on the one hand, and forgetful on the other, the sort who never locked his car, or even his house, unless his wife made him. If it were in the open, it would be in one of two places. Rutledge pulled open the center drawer of the desk and found the usual array of pencils and cheap pens.
He was always losing them, and paper clips. 1 minute gone as Rutledge carefully shuffled through the desk. Nothing. It was almost a relief, until he examined the desktop, and then he nearly laughed. Right there on the blotter, tucked into the leather edging, a plain white envelope addressed to the Secretary of State, but without a stamp. Rutledge took it from its place, holding the envelope by the edges. Unsealed. He moved the flap and extracted the contents. A single sheet of paper, two typed paragraphs. It was at this point that Cliff Rutledge got a chill. The exercise had been theoretical to this point. He could just replace it. Forget he'd been here. Forget about the phone call. Forget about everything. 2 minutes. Would Brett have receipted it? Probably not. Again, he'd been a gentleman about everything. He would not have humiliated Ed that way. Ed had done the honorable thing by resigning, and Brett would have responded honorably, undoubtedly shaken his hand with a sorrowful look, and that would have been that. 2:15. Decision. Rutledge tucked the letter in his jacket pocket, headed for the door, switched off the lights, and returned to the corridor, stopping short of his own office door. There he waited half a minute. "Hi, George."
"Hello, Mr. Rutledge."
"I just sent Wally down to get coffee for the floor."
"Good idea, sir."
"Bad night. Is it true that—"
"Yeah, afraid so.
Brett was probably killed with all the rest."
"Damn."
"Might be a good idea to lock his office up. I just checked the door and—"
"Yes, sir."
George Armitage pulled out his key ring and found the proper one.
"He's always so—"
"I know." Rutledge nodded.
"You know, 2 weeks ago I found his vault unlocked. Like he turned the handle but forgot to spin the dial."
A shake of the head.
"I guess he never got hisself robbed, eh?"
"That's the problem with security," the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs sympathized. "The big boys never seem to pay attention, right?" How beautiful it was! Who had done it? The question had a cursory answer. The TV reporters, with little else to do, kept telling their cameras to look at the tail fin. He remembered the logo well enough, having long ago participated in an operation that had blown up an aircraft with the red crane on its rudder fin. He almost regretted it now, but envy prevented that. It was a matter of propriety. As one of the world's foremost terrorists, he used the word within his own mind, and in that private place relished the term, though he couldn't use it elsewhere. Such an event ought to have been his doing, not the work of some amateur. For that's who it had been. An amateur whose name he would learn in due course, along with everyone else on Earth, from television coverage. The irony was striking enough. Since puberty, he devoted himself to the study and practice of political violence, learning, thinking, planning, and executing such acts, first as a participant, then as a leader, commander. And now what? Some amateur had outstripped him, had outstripped the entire clandestine world to which he belonged. It would have been embarrassing except for the beauty of the event. His trained mind ran over the possibilities, and the analysis came rapidly. A single man, perhaps two. More likely, one. As always, he thought with a tight-lipped nod, one man willing to die, to sacrifice himself for the cause. Whatever cause he might have served, could be more formidable than an army. In the case at hand, the man in question had possessed special skills and access to special means, both of which had served his purpose well. That was luck, as was the single-actor aspect to the feat. It was easy for a single man to keep a secret. He grunted. That was the problem he'd always faced. The really hard part was finding the right people, people whom he could trust, who wouldn't boast to or confide in others, who shared his own sense of mission, who had his own discipline, and who were truly willing to risk their lives. That last criterion was the price of entry, once easy enough to establish, but
but now it was becoming so much harder in a changing world. The well into which he dipped was running dry, and it did no good to deny it. He was running out of the truly devoted. Always smarter and farther seeing than his contemporaries, he himself had faced the necessity of participating in 3 real operations, and though he'd had the steel in his soul to do what had to be done, he didn't crave to repeat it. It was too dangerous, after all. It wasn't that he feared the consequences of his action. It was that a dead terrorist was as dead as his victims, and dead men carried out no more missions. Martyrdom was something he'd been prepared to risk, but nothing he'd ever really sought. He wanted to win, after all, to reap the benefits of his action, to be recognized as a winner, liberator, conqueror, to be in the books which future generations would read as something other than a footnote. The successful mission on the TV in his bedroom would be remembered as an awful thing by most. Not the act of a man, but something akin to a natural disaster, because, elegant as it was, it served no political purpose. And that was the problem with the mad act of one dedicated martyr. Luck wasn't enough. There had to be a reason, a result. Such a successful act was only so if it led to something else. This manifestly had not. And that was too bad. It wasn't often that... No, the man reached for his orange juice and sipped it before he allowed his mind to proceed. Wasn't often? This had never happened, had it? That was a largely philosophical question. He could say, hearkening back to history, that the assassins had been able to topple, or at least decapitate, governments. But back then such a task had meant the elimination of a single man. And for all the bravura shown by emissaries of that hilltop fortress, the modern world was far too complex. Kill a president or prime minister, even one of the lingering kings some nations clung to, and there was another to step into the vacant place, as had evidently happened in this case. But this one was different. There was no cabinet to stand behind the new man, to show solidarity and determination and continuity on their angry faces. If only something else, something larger and more important, had been ready when the aircraft had made its fall, then this thing of beauty would have been more beautiful still. That it hadn't could not be changed. But as with all such events, there was much to learn from both its success and failure, and its aftermath, planned or not, was very, very real. In that sense, it was tragic. An opportunity had been wasted. If only he'd known. If only the man who'd flown that airplane to its final destination had let someone know what was planned. But that wasn't the way of martyrs, was it? The fools had to think alone, act alone, and die alone. And in their personal success lay ultimate failure. Or perhaps not. The aftermath was still there.
Mr. President? A Secret Service agent had picked up the phone. Ordinarily it would have been a Navy yeoman, but the detail was still a little too shell-shocked to allow just anyone into the sit room.
FBI, sir.
Ryan pulled the phone from its holder under the desktop.
Yes?
Dan Murray here.
Jack nearly smiled to hear a familiar voice, and a friendly one at that. He and Murray went back a very long way indeed. At the other end, Murray must have wanted to say, "Hi, Jack," but he wouldn't. Couldn't be so familiar without being so bidden. And even if Jack had encouraged him, the man would have felt uncomfortable to do so, and would have run the further risk of being thought an ass-kisser within his own organization. One more obstacle to being normal, Jack reflected. Even his friends were now distancing themselves.
"What is it, Dan?"
"Sorry to bother you, but we need guidance on who's running the investigation. There's a bunch of people running around on the hill right now, and..."
"Unity of command," Jack observed sourly.
He didn't have to ask why Murray was calling him. All those who could have decided this issue at a lower level were dead.
What's the law say for this?
It doesn't, really, Murray replied.
The discomfort in his voice was clear. He didn't wish to bother the man who had once been his friend, and might still be, in less official circumstances. But this was business, and business had to be carried out.
Multiple jurisdictions?
To a fare thee well, Murray confirmed with an unseen nod.
I guess we call it a terrorist incident.
We have a tradition of that, you and I, don't we? Jack asked.
That we do, sir.
Sir, Ryan thought. Damn it. But he had another decision to make. Jack scanned the room before replying. The Bureau is the lead agency on this. Everybody reports to you. Pick a good man to run things.
Yes, sir.
Dan?
Yes, Mr. President?
Who's senior over at FBI?
The associate director is Chuck Floyd. He's down at Atlanta to give a speech, and...
Then there would be the assistant directors, all senior to Murray.
I don't know him.
I do know you. You're acting director until I say otherwise.
That shook the other side of the connection, Ryan immediately sensed.
Jack, I liked Shaw too, Dan. You've got the job.
Yes, Mr. President.
Ryan replaced the phone and explained what he'd just done. Price objected first. Sir, any attack on the President is under the jurisdiction of... Ryan cut her off. They have more resources, and somebody has to be in command. I want this one settled as quickly as possible.
We need a special commission. This was Arnie Van Dam.
Headed by whom, President Ryan asked? A member of the Supreme Court? Couple of senators and congressmen?
Murray's a pro from way back. Pick a good...
Whoever's the senior career member of the Department of Justice's criminal division will oversee the investigation. Andrea, find me the best investigator in the service to be Murray's chief assistant. We don't have outsiders to use, do we? We run this from the inside.
Let's pick the best people and let them run with it. Like, we act as though we trust the agencies who are supposed to do the work.
He paused.
I want this investigation to run fast, okay?
Yes, Mr. President. Agent Price bobbed her head, and Ryan caught an approving nod from Arnie Van Dam. Maybe he was doing something right, Jack allowed himself to think. The satisfaction was short-lived enough. Against the wall in the far corner was a bank of television sets. All showed essentially the same picture now, and the flash of a photographer's strobe on all four sets caught the President's eyes. He turned to see four iterations of a body bag being carried down the steps of the Capitol building's west wing. It was one more cadaver to identify. Large or small, male or female, important or not, one couldn't tell from the rubberized fabric of the bag. There were only the strained, cold, sad faces of the firefighters carrying the damned thing, and that had attracted the attention of a nameless newspaper photographer and his camera and his flash, and so brought their president back to a reality he now again shrank from. The TV cameras followed the trio, two living, one dead, down the steps to an ambulance whose open doors revealed a pile of such bags. The one they were carrying was passed across gently, the professional showing mercy and solicitude to the body which the living world had forsaken. Then they headed back up the steps to get the next one. The Situation Room fell silent as all eyes took in the same picture. A few deep breaths were taken, and eyes were too steely or too shocked as yet for tears as, two by two, they turned away to stare down at the polished oak of the table. A coffee cup scraped and rattled its way from a saucer. The slight noise only made the silence worse, for no one had the words to fill the void.
"What else has to be done now?" Jack asked.
It hit him so hard, the fatigue of the moment. The earlier racing of his heart in the face of death, and in fear for his family, and in agony at the loss, was taking its toll on him now. His chest seemed empty, his arms weighed down, as though the sleeves of his coat were made of lead, and suddenly it was an effort just to hold up his head. It was 11:35, after a day that had begun at 4:10 in the morning,
filled with interviews about a job he'd held for all of 8 minutes before his abrupt promotion. The adrenaline rush which had sustained him was gone, its two-hour duration making him all the more exhausted for its length. He looked around with what seemed an important question.
"Where do I sleep tonight?"
"Not here," Ryan decided instantly. "Not in a dead man's bed, on dead man's sheets, a few feet from a dead man's kids. He needed to be with his own family. He needed to look at his own children, probably asleep by now, because children slept through anything. Then to feel his wife's arms around him, because that was the one constant in Ryan's world, the single thing that he would never allow to change, despite the cyclonic events that had assailed a life he had neither courted nor expected. The Secret Service agents shared a look of mutual puzzlement before Andrea Price spoke, taking command, as was her nature, and now her job. "Marine Barracks, 8th and I?" Ryan nodded. "That'll do for now." Price spoke into her radio microphone, which was pinned to the collar of her suit jacket. "Swordsman is moving. Bring the cars to the west entrance." The agents of the detail rose. As one person, they unbuttoned their coats, and as they passed out the door, hands reached for their pistols. "We'll shake you loose at 5, Van Dam promised, adding, "Make sure you get the sleep you need." His answer was a brief, empty stare as Ryan left the room. There, a White House usher put a coat on him. Whose it was or where it might have come from, Jack didn't think to ask. He climbed into the Chevy Suburban back seat, and it moved off at once, with an identical vehicle in front and three more behind. Jack could have avoided the sights, but not the sounds, for sirens were still wailing beyond the armored glass, and it would have been cowardice to look away in any case. The fire glow was gone, replaced by the sparkling of lights from scores of emergency vehicles, some moving, most not, on or around the hill. The police were keeping downtown streets clear, and the presidential motorcade headed rapidly east, 10 minutes later arriving at the Marine Barracks. Here everyone was awake now, properly uniformed, and every Marine in sight had a rifle or pistol in evidence. The salutes were crisp. The home of the Commandant of the Marine Corps dated back to the early 19th century, one of the few official buildings that hadn't been burned by the British during their visit in 1814. But the Commandant was dead. A widower with grown children, he'd lived here alone until this last night. Now a full colonel stood on the porch in pressed utilities with a pistol belt around his waist and a full platoon spread around the house. "Mr. President, your family is topside and all secure," Colonel Mark Porter reported immediately. "We have a full rifle company deployed on perimeter security, and another one is on the way."
"Media?" Price asked.
"I didn't have any orders about that. My orders were to protect our guests. The only people within 200 meters are the ones who belong here." "Thank you, Colonel," Ryan said, not caring about the media, and heading for the door. A sergeant held it open, saluting as a Marine ought, and without thinking, Ryan returned it. Inside, a more senior NCO pointed him up the stairs. This one also saluted, as he was under arms. It was clear to Ryan now that he couldn't go anywhere alone. Price, another agent, and two Marines followed him up the stairs. The second-floor corridor had 2 Secret Service agents and 5 more Marines. Finally, at 11:54, he walked into a bedroom to find his wife sitting.
"Hi."
"Jack?"
Her head turned.
"It's all true?"
He nodded. Then he hesitated before coming to sit next to Kathy.
"The kids?"
"Asleep."
A pause.
"They don't really know what's going on. I guess that makes 4 of us," she added.
5.
"The president's dead?"
Kathy turned to see her husband nod.
"I hardly got to know him."
"Good guy. Their kids are at the house, asleep. I didn't know if I was supposed to do anything, so I came here." Ryan reached for his collar and pulled the tie loose. It seemed to take a considerable effort to do so.
Better not to disturb the kids, he decided. It would have been hard to walk that far anyway.
And now?
I have to sleep. They get me up at 5.
What are we going to do?
I don't know. Jack managed to get out of his clothes, hoping that the new day would contain some of the answers that the night merely concealed. Chapter 2. Pre-dawn. It was to be expected that they'd be as exactly punctual as their electronic watches could make them. It seemed to Ryan that he'd hardly closed his eyes when the gentlest of taps at the door startled him off the pillow. There came the brief moment of confusion normal to the moment of awakening in any place other than one's own bed. Where am I? The first organized thought told him that he'd dreamed a lot of things, and maybe... But hard on the heels of that thought was the internal announcement that the worst of the dream was still real. He was in a strange place, and there was no other explanation for it. The tornado had swept him up into a whirling mass of terror and confusion, and then deposited him here, and here was neither Kansas nor Oz. About the best thing he could say after 5 or 10 seconds of orientation was that he didn't have the expected headache from sleep deprivation, and that he wasn't quite so tired. He slid out from under the covers. His feet found the floor, and he made his way to the door. "Okay, I'm up," he told the wooden door. Then he realized that his room didn't have an attached bathroom, and he'd have to open the door. That he did. "Good morning, Mr. President." A young and rather earnest-looking agent handed him a bathrobe. Again it was the job of an orderly, but the only Marine he saw in the corridor was wearing a pistol belt. Jack wondered if there had been another turf fight the night before between the Marine Corps and the Secret Service to see who had primacy of place in the protection of their new commander-in-chief. Then he realized, with a start, that the bathrobe was his own. "We got some things for you last night," the agent explained in a whisper. A second agent handed over Kathy's rather tattered maroon housecoat. So someone had broken into their home last night. Must have, Jack realized, as he hadn't handed over his keys to anyone, and defeated the burglar alarm he'd installed a few years earlier. He padded back to the bed and deposited the housecoat there before heading back out. Yet a third agent pointed him down the hall to an unoccupied bedroom. 4 suits were hanging on a poster bed, along with 4 shirts, all newly pressed by the look of them, along with 50 of ties and everything else. It wasn't so much pathos as desperation, Jack realized. The staff knew, or at least had an idea, of what he was going through, and every single thing they could do to make things easier for him was being done with frantic perfection. Someone had even spit-shined his 3 pair of black shoes to Marine specifications. They'd never looked so good before, Ryan thought, heading for the bathroom, where, of course, he found all of his things, even his usual bar of zest soap. Next to that was the skin-friendly stuff Kathy used. Nobody thought that being president was easy, but he was now surrounded by people who were grimly determined to eliminate every small worry he might have. A warm shower helped loosen his muscles, and clouded the mirror with mist, which made things even better when he shaved. The usual morning mechanics were finished by 5:20, and Ryan made his way down the stairs. Outside he saw through a window a phalanx of camouflage-clad Marines stood guard on the quad, their breathing marked by little white puffs. Those inside braced to attention as he passed. Perhaps he and his family had gotten a few hours of sleep, but no one else had. That was something he needed to remember, Jack told himself as the smells drew him to the kitchen. "Attention on deck." The voice of the sergeant major of the Marine Corps was muted in deference to the sleeping children upstairs, and for the first time since dinner the previous night Ryan managed a smile. "Settle down, Marines." President Ryan headed toward the coffee pot, but a corporal beat him there. The correct proportions of cream and sugar were added to the mug. Again, someone had done some homework, before she handed it across. "The staff is in the dining room, sir," the sergeant major told him.
Thank you.
President Ryan headed that way. They looked the worse for wear, making Jack feel briefly guilty for his shower-fresh face. Then he